Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Thank you for downloading this podcast of Desert Island Discs from BBC Radio 4. For rights reasons, the music choices are shorter than in the radio broadcast. For more information about the programme, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4. My castaway this week is the best-selling writer Robert Harris. He was apparently a political junkie from a young age, just six when he penned the essay Why Me and My Dad Don't Like Sir Alec Douglas Hume. His first novel had a somewhat catchier title, Fatherland. In it, he imagined a world after the Nazis had won the Second World War. It sold more than 3 million copies and made him a household name. His later books include Enigma, about the wartime codebreakers at Bletchley Park, and the political thriller The Ghost, both also successful films. He has spent years as a journalist too, writing in his phrase, history on the wing. Politics is the essence of life, he says. It's the most incredible theatre of characters, drama, incident, unexpected events, human frailties, astonishing courage. The whole business, the cavalcade, fascinates me all the time. So you're fascinated by politics, you have the education, you have the background, it's in your blood, but you've never been tempted to stand for Parliament yourself. Why not?
I think that I'm at heart a writer, and I don't think I'm a very good team player. I have no desire for power, actually. I hate bossing people around and wouldn't want to do it. And I do admire people that have the tenacity to do it, actually.
Do you admire politicians? Because, of course, that's not a very fashionable opinion these days for people to hold them in high esteem.
Admire may not be the right word. Sympathise, understand, see the distorting effects of the trade on human beings and how they have to adapt to it. And, of course, part of this entails necessary hypocrisy and deceit. Only writ large. I mean, I think we all practice what politicians do, but on a smaller, more private scale, we're not caught out. We don't have to answer for our every statement they do. And it's very easy to make politicians look villainous or ridiculous. It goes with the territory.
You made your living as a journalist for some years. You also worked in TV. We'll talk about both of those later. But now a best-selling author, and you choose still to dip in and out of journalism. Do you find it quite easy to travel between fact and fiction?
Well, I suppose a lot of people would say journalists don't
I'm giving you the benefit of the doubt.
Make a long journey there. I do some journalism from time to time to sort of keep my hand in, and because, you know, it's useful to do it. But I see myself primarily, and have done now for the best part of 20 years, as a writer of fiction.
Given your stage in life, given your experience of writing fiction, do you find yourself being more sympathetic towards people because you probably do understand them in the round?
I think maybe as one gets older, one becomes more sympathetic towards people, don't you think? I don't think that's necessarily a result of inventing characters. I think it's as you make your own mistakes or you see your friends make mistakes, you get to be more, I think, sympathetic to people generally. Well, maybe you don't. Maybe one becomes an angry old man waving your stick at the modern world, but I don't tend to do that.
What about writing about Hitler, then, that you've done with great success? Did you come to understand him and be... maybe sympathetic's the wrong word, but at least understand what it was that so captivated the people in at that moment in time?
Yes, I mean, I think, as you say, sympathetic is not the right word at all, but an understanding. I think one can understand things about Hitler. For instance, he went through 4 years right on the front line in the First World War. I mean, with no kind of grief counselling or trauma counselling or whatever, anyone who went through that is going to come out of it somewhat strange, I think. Now that so many years have elapsed since he died, I think it's more useful for us to try to understand what sort of person he was than to simply demonise him.
And you say you live in the house that Hitler built?
Well, I'm not very good with money, but the one thing I did do that was sensible was after Fatherland, we saw that my wife and I had this house in the country, and I wrote a cheque for it, and that's it. We've lived in it ever since. And my friends all said, that's the house that Hitler bought.
Let's dive into your music then. What are we going to hear first off this morning, Robert Harris?
Well, I very much like Baroque music, and I think probably Bach is the greatest composer. And this piece of music from St. Matthew's Passion, I used to play every night when I'd finished the day's writing of Fatherland, actually, in the early 90s. At that time, on computers, you used to have to go through quite a laborious process of saving files and so on, your day's work. And as I did that each day, I would always play this particular track.
Ulrich Kold singing the aria Mache dich mein Herze rein, Make thyself clean my heart, from Bach's St. Matthew Passion. Robert Harris, you've written many books where the backdrop is war, Fatherland, Enigma, The Ghost, even Gotcha. I'm wondering if there's a little part of you that thinks you would have been quite a different person, maybe a better person, if you'd fought in a war.
Well, I think that I was born in 1957, so only 12 years after the end of the Second World War, and it was a very big thing in my childhood growing up. I mean, it pervaded popular culture, comics, what was on television, movies and so on. And so there is a little part of me, as for many men of my generation, I think, wonder how we would have reacted, you know. And I think there is a sense that our generation has not been tested in the way that our parents and grandparents' generation was. And we never had that sense of commonality, of fighting a greater enemy, of all being thrown together. I mean, I'm very relieved, let me hasten to add, that I haven't had to fight. But nevertheless, you feel that there's a part of your personality that's not been explored.
How do you think it shapes, or do you think it shapes, the decisions that our politicians make then these days? The fact that, of course, they are part of that generation that has never been to war.
I think that's very interesting. One of the things that surprised me about Tony Blair, who I knew quite well before he became Prime Minister, was how readily he would engage in war compared to his predecessors, who had more experience of it.
So never been to war yourself, but you did go into some sort of battle in the 1980s. You worked on Newsnight along with Jeremy Paxman. You ventured into, this was about the time of the Afghan-Russian conflict, you ventured into the Hindu Kush. What did you take with you? Let me get this clear, because I've read some very scurrilous rumours that you took some carpet slippers and a nice comfy pillow.
This is... This has been exaggerated with the retelling. Actually, Jeremy and I were working on Panorama together, and we went to the Khyber Pass, where to stay in Peshawar. And there was some talk that we might go over the border with the Mujahideen forces and get hit by helicopter gunships. I had privately resolved that this was not something I intended to do. Jeremy, far more the gung-ho war reporter, came out with a sort of thermal sleeping bag or whatever, and I kind of came out with a 19th century biography and a dressing gown. And when we unpacked in the Peshawar hotel, it was clear we'd come on different trips.
But still good friends.
Jeremy's been a very good friend, yes, ever since. I'm godfather to his eldest daughter, he is to mine, and we still go on holiday every year, but now we do definitely stay in hotels.
Tell me about the fascination with politics then. How far back did it begin, and why did it begin?
Well, my father was very interested in politics, and, you know, one imbibes one's parents' interest in politics. So I think it started then. My father had no interest in football, and neither did I. And politics, in a sense, became our football. I mean, it was something we would chew over. Not just me, my mother and my sister as well.
Let's have some more music then. What are we going to hear next?
Well, my father was a big influence, and my upbringing also touched on that period of the war, which I became very interested in. And my father loved big band music. and particularly Tommy Dorsey. And I have a great love of Tommy Dorsey's On the Sunny Side of the Street, which I think the moment you hear those opening chords, you're immediately back in the Second World War.
Tommy Dorsey and On the Sunny Side of the Street. So, Robert Harris, let's find out a little more about the early years. You were born in 1957 in Nottingham. What was the family home like?
Well, the family home was a council house that my grandfather got in 1937 when it had been newly built, and that was where I spent my first 6 years. My sister was born 2 years after I was. I had a very happy childhood, actually.
What did your dad do?
He was a printer at a big firm called Foreman's in Nottingham. He had left school at 14. He left school on the Friday, I think, and started work on the Saturday morning.
And it's right, is it, that he hadn't fought in the war?
No, he contracted polio when he was about 18 months old. And, I mean, he could walk around all right, but he had a profound limp. And I think that that experience really formed him. I mean, he had to have electric convulsive therapy as a two-year-old. I remember him describing how his father would come towards him holding the calipers for the electricity, and he'd start howling and trying to get away. He was quite a tough character. I mean, you know, he hadn't had it that easy, I think.
And what about your mother? What was she like?
My mother was a very sweet character, very quiet. She spent the first part of the war on a farm in Derbyshire, and then she was conscripted to Ericsson's, the big telecommunications firm near Nottingham, and then she went to work at Foreman's, and that's where my parents met. And nowadays we hear a lot of complaints about how many young people go to university, and it may be that too many do go, and some of it is wasted, but I always think of my parents, who were both bright and who never got a chance. You know, they left school far too early.
So what was their expectation, if indeed there was one, for you and your sister?
Well, I think my father very much wanted me to be a solicitor, because I remember him telling me I could earn £100 a week. And I think he did have academic ambitions for me, but there was no, I'd have never felt pushed, and I see a lot more of my friends and people that I know now pushing their children a lot more. I am not conscious of ever having that. I was very fortunate, really.
Let's have some more music. What are we going to hear now?
My father was interested in jazz music. My mother was interested in classical music. And I remember when I was applying for university, about to take the entrance exam for Cambridge, that I took a few days off school. And I used to play Vivaldi to get myself in the mood for this exam. And it seems to me completely to capture in music the architecture of Cambridge. So I would like Vivaldi's Gloria.
The opening of Vivaldi's Gloria with the English Concert and Choir led by Trevor Pinnock. Robert Harris, heading to Cambridge then, but both of your parents, were they cool, calm and collected about that, or did they have worries for you?
I think they were slightly astonished,
were they?
As indeed I was, in a way. I think it's only now that I've got children, one of whom started university, one will be starting next year, that I appreciate what it must have meant to them. But, you know, I was, when I look back, it was that awful thing of, you know, they would drop me off there and I couldn't wait for them to go. You know, that terrible way that one is with one's parents. I'm sure my children are with me.
And you seem to have settled into it pretty well, and you launched yourself into student journalism.
Yes, I was fortunate in two ways. One is that I didn't have that crippling sense of trying to live up to something that my parents or teachers had imposed upon me. I was liberated. You know, every day that I didn't have to work in a factory was a day of victory for me. I was playing with a casino's money, and I think that gave me a terrific kind of confidence. I saw many contemporaries who were sort of weighed down by their background.
And you're meaning here people who'd come from public schools,
yes,
whose parents expect them to be,
yes,
the QC or
especially
be the,
yes, if the parents had scrimped and saved to put them through that education. And then secondly, I always knew what I wanted to do. I mean, from the age of about 8, I knew I wanted to write. So the moment I got to university, I just made a beeline for the student paper and started work on it the following week and continued to write throughout the time at Cambridge.
Were you overflowing with confidence?
I don't know, maybe in some insufferable way I was. I certainly never felt on the back foot, despite the fact that I'd been to a comprehensive school. I felt that, in a sense, it was a source of strength. I didn't have any difficulty about that. As I say, I took a view, it was all there to have a go at it. And if one fell on one's face, well, so what?
And what about expectation then with your own children? You have 4 children, as you say, they're about to, some of them embark on that period of their lives. What advice do you give them about what they should
I wouldn't dream of proffering any advice. That would be a route to humiliation. It's funny, isn't it? I can see that my background, and oddly enough, was wonderful in that it gave me, I knew where I had to go. You know, I had to sort of get up, get out, get on. And I think it's harder in a way, actually, if both your parents went to university and you grow up and things are quite comfortable. Where's the spur? It's tougher, you know.
And you say that from the age of 8 you knew that you wanted to be a writer. Have you always been, I mean, are you indeed, when you're writing now, obsessive about writing? Does it become the only thing that's happening?
I think that when a book starts to form in your mind, you often sort of drift off. You wake up in the small hours of the night, actually, thinking about it. And it is obsessive work. And I think if you weren't obsessive about it, it probably wouldn't come alive.
Let's have some more music. What are we going to hear now?
Well, in my view, the greatest contribution of the Americans to 20th century culture was the musical. This is just one out of a dozen or more musicals I'd have happily chosen, but I have gone for Guys and Dolls and the great show-stopping song with its wonderful lyrics, Sit Down, You're Rockin' the Boat.
And I said to myself, sit down, you're rocking a boat. Said to myself, sit down, you're rocking a boat. And the devil will drag you under with a soul so heavy you'd never float. Sit down, sit down, sit down, sit down, sit down, you're rocking a boat.
Sit down, you're rocking, sit down, sit down, you're rocking a boat.
That was Stubby K and Sit Down, You're Rockin' the Boat from the original Broadway cast recording of Guys and Dolls. Robert Harris, you've said of today's Westminster, not only do we lack political personalities, but the vibrancy that should be part of the political debate. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think one's got to be careful falling into the trap of thinking everything was much better years ago. But nevertheless, when I was taking an interest in politics when I was growing up, the great set-piece speeches at party conferences, the clash at a party conferences, the oratory in the House of Commons. Some sense of that has vanished from our political culture, and we're left with a kind of rather dull trench warfare in which it's all defence and you're just frightened of making a mistake. And I suppose that this is down to the effects of television and around-the-clock media. It's not that I think that the people are of lesser quality, but they don't somehow have the room to perform that they used to.
I'm wondering, though, you were political editor of The Observer during the 1990s, and I'm wondering, I mean, you were one of those people who urged Labour to get their act together, to become this slick, mean machine that was able to influence and indeed manipulate the media.
Yes, you know, mea culpa in a way, and it's a sort of example of beware of what you wish for because you may get it. But along with that, I do think came a sort of willingness to use opinion polls and focus groups to find out what people were thinking and then to reflect it back at them in policies. And that has done British politics a disservice. And, you know, look at the people turning out to vote. The numbers that vote are not what they used to be.
As a journalist, during the 97 landslide for Labour, you were at Tony Blair's side as the polling results came in. And you have mentioned, intriguingly, given what Mr Blair has subsequently said about his drinking habits, that you think one of the reasons that they allowed you to chum along with him was you became something of a drinking partner of his because nobody else wanted a drink.
Well, don't get me wrong, I'm not trying to suggest he's some kind of dipsomaniac. But he would do a big rally, it's for Glasgow or something like that, and then we'd go out to the airport to get on the plane to fly back to London, and under the seat there were always bottles that had been left by the charter air company. And Cherie didn't drink, she was there. Alistair Campbell didn't drink, he was there. The special brand's bodyguard obviously didn't drink. So Tony would rummage around, pull out a bottle and said, Robert, you'd like a drink, wouldn't you? And then under cover of pouring one for me, he was able to have one himself.
Yeah, rude not to, really.
And so, yes, I think that I would have liked to have thought that I'd been invited along because of my political insight or great power as a writer, but it may have been simply because I too would have a drink in the evening with him.
Let's have some more music. What are we going to hear?
Well, as I mentioned, my great joy is Baroque music. And it's the only music that I find is a stimulus to creativity. And I listen to it a lot. And one of the joys of the internet is that actually you can browse little-known composers much more easily than you ever could when you used to have to go into a record store. Not that I'm saying this composer is unknown, but I would like to listen to Telemann's Concerto for 3 oboes, 3 violins and bass.
Of Telemann's Concerto for 3 oboes, 3 violins and bass, played by the Concentus Musicus of Vienna, led by Nikolaus Anglancourt. So your books, translated into, 30 odd languages, something like that, they sell in their millions. Fatherland was your first piece of fiction. You have said that when you started writing it, I'm quoting you now, you felt like you had a powerful car in the garage and were switching it on and realising that there was literally nothing you could not do. How exciting.
Yes, it was terrific. I can remember it was a Saturday afternoon and I wrote the opening sentence and I practically had to go and lie down afterwards. The possibilities of it, and the feeling that I'd finally, how old was I, early 30s, that I'd finally arrived at what I wanted to do. It was overwhelming.
A bidding war broke out over your book when it was finally touted around by your agent. That must have been thrilling.
It was. Well, it was utterly bizarre. In fact, I hadn't even finished it. That happened. And I got more money, I think, than I had got in everything that I'd done earning up to that point. And I still hadn't finished the book. And then, just as I finished it, there was a BBC documentary about Alan Turing. And I thought, wouldn't that be a great character to have a code breaker as a central character and to write, set it in the war. And that was a very difficult book to write. It took me 3 years, and there was a year in there where I was really badly blocked because I'd had this success with Fatherland and I didn't really know how I'd managed it. By that time, we'd moved to the country to this house that Hitler had bought, and the rain fell and I sat and stared at the blank screen. Anyway, one got through it.
What about The Ghost then? People will be familiar with the book, and of course it was turned into a successful and well-reviewed movie. Did you co-write the screenplay, or you wrote the screenplay? You worked with Roman Polanski, a very controversial figure. How did that go?
I took the view with Roman that I'd gone to start work with him when all these things that he'd done were perfectly well known, and that if I'd had some great moral objection to him, I should have not gone to work with him. Really, for 3 years, I worked quite intensively with him, saw him a lot, and controversial though he is, I'm afraid I came to like him very much. He's the most remarkable man, I think, that I have met. I mean, here is a man who had survived the Holocaust, been fed out through a hole in the wall in the Krakow ghetto, had survived. His mother had been killed at Auschwitz and had then gone through and learned his craft as a filmmaker under the communist regime and then gone to Hollywood and so on. So we had a lot to talk about and we got on very well. And as far as the events of the 1970s were concerned, I mean, it was so far in the past, 30 years in the past, no one ever talked about it when I was working with him. It sounds strange to say it now that the controversy is reignited, but at that time it didn't seem an issue.
Just to remind people, of course, it was charges of unlawful sex with a 13-year-old girl that he was charged with in America and had been unable to return to America since the charges had been brought. During the final stages of production, though, was that when he was finally arrested?
Well, yes, we worked on the movie. I went and saw him in Paris at the beginning of September last year. And then 2 weeks later, he was arrested and thrown into jail. And the movie sort of teetered on the edge of collapse. But fortunately, he'd got most of it done. And there was a slight sense of uneased by the Swiss who had arrested him. I mean, he'd been a resident. He'd been flying, going back and forth over the border for 20 or 30 years. So that they did actually allow him even a cutting room in the prison. So that, and the film editor came from Paris to work on the movie. It was a very surreal time.
Did he seem changed to you, given that you'd known him throughout the years when he wasn't being actively pursued?
I haven't detected too much of a change in it. It was very, very grim for his children and for his family, needless to say, and I think that was pretty traumatic. But he's a survivor. I mean, you know, he survived the Holocaust. He survived the terrible murder of his second wife, Sharon Tate. He's tough, you know.
Indeed. Let's have some music then, Robert. What are we going to hear?
Well, I've talked about the difficulties for families of having a writer under the roof, and it was almost worse for my then-girlfriend, now-wife, Jill, who I met at the BBC, when we started going out. She thought she was just going out with a normal person, but instead of going on holidays or going out for the weekend, I would write. It was the only time I could do it, because I was working at the BBC at the time. There was a particular piece of music came out which she drew to my attention and has been our kind of piece of music ever since. And it's Elvis Costello, Every Day I Write the Book.
Don't tell me.
Elvis Costello and Every Day I Write the Book. You mentioned going into that, Robert Harris, that you and your wife, Jill Hornby, sort of think of that as your song. You met on Newsnight. She was a producer. Does that mean she has the same fascination with politics that you do?
She's interested in politics. We met on Newsnight. The moment she came into the office, my interest was piqued, and I managed to arrange for us to go off together Jim Nocte's wife, actually, Ellie Updale, was the sort of editor of the day, and I said, is there a possibility we could go off somewhere? And so we managed
on
to...
assignment.
On assignment, yes. And for some reason, we went to interview Brian Sedgemoor, then a Labour MP at the House of Commons. And so this was where I was able to make my number. And as we were driving back from the House of Commons...
It's not the perfect sort of foreplay,
he's a strange Cupid, to put it mildly. But as we came back round... the Hyde Park in the taxi together, she says that she realised we were going to get married. She felt this not with any surge of optimism or delight, but merely as a sort of fact. So it proved.
She is the sister, I say Jill Hornby. Jill Hornby people recognise as a columnist, but she's also the sister of Nick Hornby, writer of many successful books. I mean, I haven't totted up how many millions he's sold and how many millions you've sold. Have you bothered? Who wins?
I don't think that would be good for family harmony. It's been very odd. When I started going out with Jill, Nick was a teacher and not written a word of fiction or any kind of book. But it's been quite delightful, not least because, of course, we write about such completely different things. We have a good relationship.
Let's have some more music. What are we going to hear now?
Well, this goes back again to Baroque music. You'll have noticed, as I was thinking what music I'd bring, how kind of upbeat it all is. This is something which isn't upbeat, but is more profound. I think it's one of the most beautiful pieces of music that I know, and it does make one contemplate mortality, which is what it's supposed to do.
That was part of Antonio Lotti's Missa Sapiente with the Balthasar Neumann Choir and Ensemble led by Thomas Hengelbrock. Your father lived to see your success then, Robert Harris. I'm wondering, what did he make of it?
I think he was very pleased, actually. I'm very sorry he didn't live to see our two younger children. And I'm rather sorry he didn't live to see the Labour Party win in 1997. He would have enjoyed that election night, I think. But he lived long enough to see both myself and my sister settled.
I read that you have a taste for fine wine and fast cars, and we know you have a beautiful home and indeed another in the south of France. What do you think the legacy of that, of your beginnings were? You talked about the council house and those sort of simple, straightforward beginnings.
Well, I remember my father, when I finished Enigma, I celebrated by getting a Jaguar, and I took my father out for a drive in it, and I wondered whether he'd think this was extravagant. And he said, on the contrary, he said, oh, this is great. You know, you've earned it. And I'd like that philosophy. And I've always tried to do my bit to help spend us out of a recession. It's certainly true. And I don't think that that's such a bad thing.
On this island, no 24-hour news feeds, no newspapers, no blogs to read, no political discourse with other human beings. How on earth will you survive?
Well, I'd be quite happy to get away from the internet, to be quite honest with you, and indeed the 24-hour news, because it is more and more being said about less and less, in my opinion. And it's hard these days to filter out from this mass of information coming to one what is worth listening to or reading. And that aspect of going to a desert island, I think I would welcome. And I wish it was easier to just turn all this stuff off. But, of course, it is quite addictive.
Let's have some music then. Your final disc today is what?
Well, this is very appropriate. I did buy a house in the south of France in 2003 after I'd finished Pompeii, because we have four children, and I thought it would be a way of a feeble parental way of keeping seeing them if one had a place where they could we could all go on holiday. And I do love it down there. And every time I go, it's on the coast near Toulon, this wonderful piece of music sums up for me these family holidays, and it is the wonderful Charles Trenet, La Mer.
La mer, elle est la belle fille, le long des golfes clairs, et d'une chanson d'amour la mer a bercé mon cœur. Pour la vie.
That was Charles Trenet and La Mer. And so the Bible, the complete works of Shakespeare, and one other book, Robert Harris. What's your book going to be?
Well, this is tricky, to put it mildly. I decided that it would have to be something funny. And I thought about Lucky Jim, which is a book by Kingsley Amis, which I can read endlessly. But then I thought, no, the only thing I could take is Scoop, which is remains the greatest portrait of our profession that's ever been written. And I'd sit and read Scoop, I think.
It's yours, and a luxury too, of course.
Well, here again, there are so many to choose from. But I think I would like, if I could, to have a nightly hot bubble bath or fragrant bath of some sort, because I've found that there are few problems that don't seem better after a good hot bath.
Even being on your own on an island, it's yours. And if you had to choose just one disc to save, which one disc would it be?
I think because it brings back such a strong memory of a time in my life and of my wife, I would take the Elvis Costello Every Day I Write the Book.
Robert Harris, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you. It's been a joy.
You've been listening to a download from the BBC. You'll find more information on the Radio 4 website, bbc.co.uk/radio4.